This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Advocates for changes in the criminal justice system have for years pushed for Connecticut and New York to reconsider how people are detained and confined when they break the law. Their persistence may be paying off with the announced closing of large-capacity prisons. We begin in New York with one of the nation's most notorious prisons, Rikers Island. Reporter Ravain Blau has followed the effort to close this jail complex. He writes for the nonprofit online newspaper, The City, and he joins me now via Skype. Mr. Blau, welcome to The Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. First of all, for those who may not know, could you give us a bit of a background lesson on Rikers? How did Rikers Island become Rikers Island, the massive jail complex?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it dates back, I think it's in over 100 years. And it's, you know, it was a slow moving process. And like everything else, like in the city, you know, it's somewhat cyclic. When they started Rikers, it was seen as, you know, as a reform based system where, you know, there was many issues with the current lockup, you know, at the turn of the century. And there was a lot of kind of overcrowding and just a lot of abuses. And they figured that this space on this island that was owned actually, you know, by a former judge who was kind of famous or infamously, you know, involved in the slave trade. And by involved, I mean, I think he was, you know, would kind of give money to the slaves returned. He, you know, it was one complex and slowly sort of built up and up and up over the years.
And it seems like it's repeated the process then, become an overcrowded, abusive place. How many people are housed in the facility currently?
That's a good question. I think it's around a little bit over 5,000. It actually is, interestingly, the number went down drastically at the beginning of COVID. And it was actually, I think it hit like a little less than 4,000 at one point. And it was just almost like historic lows. And it's creeped back up. It's crept back up over the last few months. And it actually, there are more people now in March in Rikers than there were when there was last March. But it's still relatively low considering.
Hmm. I like to bring up a case that kind of put a spotlight on flaws in the system that involves Rikers. The case of Khalif Browder. And it put that spotlight on the flaws, and that's probably an understatement, especially for Black, brown, and poor people. He was a 16-year-old boy arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack, and I understand he spent something like 1,000 or more days at Riker just waiting for trial, and he said he was innocent. In the end, he was released with the charges dropped, but it's believed that his experience in Rikers led him to commit suicide. Are there statistics that you've run into in your reporting on how many innocent people have been held at Rikers while they're processed through the system, people like Khalif Browder?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. There isn't that sort of specific stat, but there are stats around that show kind of similar stories. I mean, the important thing to keep in mind is that the overwhelming majority of people in Rikers Island or in other city jails, you know, Rikers being the biggest complex, are pretrial detainees. So they actually have not been convicted. And that's, you know, a big part of you know, the history of Rikers Island and a big reason why people are, you know, have pushed for changes. The Khalif Browder case also really highlights issues that came up with bail reform, you know, as far as why was somebody like that held on such a sort of low-level offense, and also the use of solitary confinement against young adults, you know, extremely, extremely damaging. And as well as just, you know, what services people get once they're released. You know, how do you recover from that sort of those incidents?
And the conditions at Riker too, there have been complaints, you've covered them for decades, about the conditions at Riker. How did they become so abusive and violent? Was it a slow process? As you mentioned, the prison itself evolved from what was meant to be a reform to what they are today, or what it is today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a 413-acre island where away from New York City, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. And I think that's a big, big factor in this, where, you know, most people in New York, most New Yorkers have not been to Rikers Island and don't care, don't have a lot of interest in it. And I think that because there's not a lot of attention on there, Now, a lot of these abuses do kind of happen, or, you know, bad culture sort of seeps in. And the biggest factor, one of the biggest factors also is simply just the idea that these buildings that exist there are falling apart, and that just even the simplest, like the simple process of having, you know, a visit can take hours and hours and hours, up to 6 to 8 hours a day just to go visit someone there. And, you know, and transporting people to court, it just the location itself just lends itself to major, major problems. You know, inmates have to, detainees have to get woken up sometimes at around 3 a.m. so they can get to court by 8 a.m. And then they're brought back and it's rinse and repeat over and over again. They, you know, a lot of times the DAs use this sort of process as far as like kind of delaying the trial in order to kind of convince them to take plea deals. And that's really just by the institution itself, just the structure itself lends itself to that sort of abuse.
And again, there's, as the name suggests, it's an island, as you've mentioned. There's one way in, one way out. It's not on the way to anywhere, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. There's just one way in, one way out. There's a small bridge that takes you there. You know, at one point it actually housed over 20,000 inmates. I mean, that's not the case right now. You know, it's a really, really, really terrible place to be. There's actually a federal monitor that oversees the department. And, it, you know, every 6 months they come out a report. And they've shown over and over again, even though that there's a monitor and there's all this attention there, the number of use of force incidents is how they describe it, you know, has consistently stayed high and gone up over time. And, you know, it's just, it's a really, really terrible place to be, and has just so many, so many issues that surround it that have, you know, that it's really, really the poster child for, you know, the push for criminal justice reform to change that.
What have advocates for shutting Rikers down told you about why they think that's a better course to follow rather than improving conditions there or reforming how Rikers is used?
You know, there's a real dispute among the advocates about what the right thing to do here. I think there's a group of advocates who say that building borough-based jails closer to the court system takes away the issue of, you know, the hours and hours of long travel to the courts every day, the hours and hours of long travel towards from family members to go to Rikers Island. So that alone, just geographically speaking, it's a huge, huge difference maker. That being said, there's a real concern by advocates about transferring the culture of Rikers Island to these borough-based jails and what that might be. They do not want, and I think, you know, any reformer talks about this, nobody wants them just transferring, you know, the abuses that occur on Rikers Island to these other new jails. They feel that also structurally speaking, the new jails will prevent some of that those issues from happening. They're expecting to build sort of smaller areas that are have more better visibility lines and just better services and things of that nature. And the critics of that say, look, that was, you know, how Rikers Island itself started, you know, that there was this idea that we're going to form it, we're going to build it better, and it's going to, you know, it's going to work. And, you know, over time, that obviously has gone the opposite direction. So, you know, it's really one of those things where, you know, time will tell. And also the finances is an issue. You know, it's at least a $10 billion plan. And already the city has kind of slowly pared back the timeline. They have it on about a 10-year schedule. But, you know, due to COVID, there was a little bit of a delay on with the construction or demolition of the jail in Manhattan. And, you know, that's been a little bit on hold.
What do you hear from those who run Rikers, from the administration, from perhaps the unions that represent the guards and those who are really in close contact with the inmates there?
They're passionately against the whole idea. They think that what really needs to be done is more, you know, they need more backing and more resources to kind of handle, you know, inmates on Rikers itself. They think that can be done on Rikers. I mean, they understand, there are issues that they understand. I mean, there's issues as far as just literally like the jail stores, the doors themselves don't properly lock up sometimes. And, you know, things like that, they want fixed. They feel that can be done on Rikers Island or, you know, at the other borough-based jails that currently exist, which there's one in, or there was one in Brooklyn. And they feel like, you know, that spending $10 billion to kind of create these borough-based jails is a waste of money.
And what about people who live in the boroughs themselves? Is there any pushback from them against the idea of bringing smaller prisons back to their neighborhoods?
Yeah, I mean, it depends which area. So in New York City, there's five boroughs, as most people know, and they're scheduled to be built in four of the five boroughs. Staten Island did actually not have one being built. So that alone out of the gate was an issue because, people in Staten Island were like, we don't want a jail being built here. And the mayor himself and the de Blasio administration said, okay, we're not going to push this issue there. So they got excluded from the plan, even though they have the same issue as far as how do you get to court in Staten Island. The city's plan is to move people from Brooklyn to Staten Island and to that jail. The Brooklyn jail, the Manhattan jail, and the Queens jail are all going to go to spots where there was previously jails or currently is a jail there. So it really kind of depends on each borough what the opposition is. Queens and the Bronx have been really the most vocal about opposition. They're upset about parking, about changing the neighborhood, the value. People in Brooklyn point out, or the city officials point out, that they reopened the Brooklyn jail, a bunch of years ago, and there was neighborhood concerns, and it actually turned out to be not the case, and the neighborhood is flourishing, and real estate values there are through the roof. So I think it really kind of depends on the areas that they're talking about.
So, Mr. Blau, in your reporting, you must have visited Rikers Island. Can you paint a picture for us? What was it like there?
Yeah, I mean, visits to Rikers Island are intense. When I go, I typically take the bus, and you see, it's one of the saddest things I ever do. You see mostly women, minorities, a lot of children that come to visit their loved ones. And it's a really long process. It's actually heart-wrenching to go through, frankly. I was there once, and there was this woman who had a child with her, I think two children, and they weren't clear, like, if they could bring in diapers. Like, the rules are really unclear. They've changed some of that recently, but, you can't even kind of, like, bring – it's difficult to bring in snacks for the kids. And then they're stuck for hours and hours, and kids are, like, need food, all the time. Just the buildings itself are old and kind of grimy, and it's really one of the most absolutely depressing places you'll ever see. I think there were studies done for officers, right? They have like a kind of a pension system, and they use actuaries to see like the average life expectancy, and I think it's shockingly low. I forgot what it was. I think it actually might be like in the 50s, like late 50s or 60s, and I think there have been studies that show that like the second you kind of as officers step in to this environment, like your whole stress level just goes up automatically. And, when you make these visits, you really get like just a one day sense of that. I mean, it's just so institutional. It's so depressing and it's so intense. Like you can't walk, very far without having to kind of have a pass or, get escorted. And, it's just such a lack of humanity there. It's hard to explain. It really, really is.
You mentioned the numbers are far lower now than they were at a peak of 20,000. Is the makeup of the population still the same though? Is it disproportionately people of color who are incarcerated there?
Yeah, and the makeup is a conversation depending kind of who you ask in the broader conversation. Now they say there's a big argument that they highlight that if the population is so low, then why is the violence still sort of so high or proportionately? And, the union will say, well, because the people that are there now are more violent than they were, previously. There's just a smaller group of more violent people. The city will say, well, the reason why the violence is still a problem is in part because 40% of the entire population has some level of mental illness. And, you talk to people who've been in the system, who have kind of been around the system for many, many years, and they'll say, look, that 40% number is high, obviously, but it's always been very high. Like, Rikers Island has always been a place where people with severe mental illness end up and then really struggle to operate within the strict rules and regulations that exist in that world.
It sounds from your description of a visit there like the nature of the facility itself is conducive to aggravating a mental illness or creating one where there wasn't one.
1,000%. I mean, 1,000%. And that's one of the big arguments. And like, I wish more people kind of listened and heard this, that conversation, which is like, there's sort of this attitude of like, well, somebody acts out violently, And instead of getting the person services or intense, it's like services, home care, counseling, they're thrown into this environment where when they act out again, they're thrown into solitary, which completely exacerbates the issue and, makes it worse. And frankly, a lot of times, you hear stories where you hear family members saying, well, the person had some issues, some mental health issues. He came home from Rikers and it was, unrecognizable. And that's really the bigger conversation. We talk about shutting down Rikers, creating a better environment for people like this. It's a conversation of like, well, what does that environment look like? Does that include the services that these people need? Right. And a lot of people say, look, these people shouldn't be in a jail environment, period. They need mental health care. They need intense mental health care. And if that means in some type of institutional care, so be it. But the Rikers environment or even a new borough-based jail environment is not the place to be.
It sounds like there's quite a long ways to go, even though there's a closing date on the calendar, so to speak, for Rikers. It sounds like there's a long way to go before the other end is reached, a system that houses the inmates differently.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm actually working on a book with a former colleague of mine, an oral history about Rikers Island. And we've had the fortune to talk to, close to 100 people, former inmates, officers, officials. And, everybody says, this is a long process. And, there's a lot of suffering that's been going on there. And, there's a lot of talk about changing it, but, it's still really, really a far way off.
We'd love to talk with you when that book is published.
That would be amazing. I really love that.
Reporter Ruvain Blau is a journalist with the nonprofit online newspaper The City in New York City. In July, the Supermax Northern Correctional Institution in Somers, Connecticut, will close. The State Department of Corrections has been criticized for its use of solitary confinement at Northern. A UN torture expert also found it to be out of bounds. The closure is a significant victory for criminal justice reformers who have fought for years to shut Northern down. With me now via Skype is Raisha Bivens. She is a justice advocate and digital organizer and board member for Stop Solitary Connecticut. Hello, Ms. Bivens, and welcome to The Full Story.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. First of all, could you tell us something about your organization, Stop Solitary Connecticut?
Sure. Stop Solitary Connecticut was founded years ago. It is part of a national organization and program called the Religious Campaign to End Torture. And it was started because people in the United States started to recognize that although we talk about torture happening in other countries and less developed nations, for lack of a better way to describe that, people started to realize that torture was happening right on American soil in our prisons. And that's how our organization got founded in Connecticut. And there's a lot of organizations that are a part of the National Religious Campaign to End Torture across the United States. So our mission is to end solitary confinement in Connecticut. As you said in your introduction, it's recognized as a form of torture to hold people in solitary confinement for 14 days or longer. And that's under international law and the Mandela rules. This is happening in all prisons in Connecticut. And although you're highlighting the victory with Northern, our mission is to really end solitary confinement and extreme isolation in every prison in Connecticut.
Could you talk more about why it is considered torture? Why is solitary confinement considered torture?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. So imagine being in a cell the size of the bathroom, of your bathroom, or a small bathroom, or the size of a parking lot, with very little light coming through. In as little as 7 days, researchers have said that being in solitary confinement could cause irreparable psychological damage. And as little as 7 days, people can start to hallucinate, hear auditory hallucinations, lose touch with reality. Many times people may become suicidal and they may cut themselves just to feel something. People are deprived. They're deprived of sunlight. They're deprived of contact with other people. they're deprived of social socialization, and it's sensory deprivation. So imagine being there beyond 14 days, you know, every single day, and you may only get 15 minutes out of your cell to take a shower, or you may get an hour, but when you're taken out of your cell, you're in a cage to go outside. It's just really debilitating for human beings that need social interaction, that need sunlight to actually be able to thrive and be well. So this is just some of the, you know, brief reasons why it's considered torture by the United Nations.
And is this how solitary was used at Northern in Connecticut?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Northern, there. So I want to say a couple things. Mm-hmm. The conditions at Northern are often replicated in other prisons in Connecticut. But why Northern is considered one of the worst prisons in Connecticut is because of the design of it. Every single person that has been in Northern says it feels like you're underground, and it was designed that way. It actually was designed, we believe, to psychologically break people. So yes, these are the conditions at Northern. And what's worse is that people actually can be shackled in their cell. So it's almost like they're in a prison, inside a prison. I'm not sure if you've seen, you know, the lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU and Yale shortly before the governor announced Northern would be closing. But the people initiating that lawsuit, all of them had a serious mental illness, and they described conditions such as having to go on the floor and eat their food like a dog because they were shackled not only at their wrists, but at their legs. And that is common, that people have what's called in-cell confinement and in-cell restraints. So that's why the conditions at Northern are especially deplorable, but we are out to end these similar conditions in all prisons in Connecticut.
Has that practice, that solitary practice, continued at Northern to this day, or have they stopped using it?
No. As far as I know, this practice is continuing. This practice is continuing, and this is in particular why the lawsuit hasn't been withdrawn with the announcement of Northern closing, because while people are there, they need to be treated humanely. So it's still happening.
Does the closing of Northern signal something to you? Do you think this is so important because it's perhaps the beginning of a movement toward ending solitary elsewhere in the state?
You know, that's a very good question. I think for myself, who's been a justice advocate and activist for a couple years now, I got involved when my own brother was incarcerated in a prison in Connecticut, where he was in his cell for 21 hours out the day in the general population. And he has schizophrenia. And he was in one of two hospitals in Connecticut that actually housed people with serious mental illness. So I was appalled as someone who practiced social work for 12 years to find that even people with diagnosed serious mental illness were being kept in these very isolative conditions. And that happens routinely at prisons like Gardner Correctional, Cheshire, McDougal. And although this definitely signals a victory, we at Stop Solitary, as well as a lot of the organizations we collaborate with, know that we can't stop. Because unfortunately, what we've seen is that sometimes Department of Corrections will change something, and it'll look like it's going to lead to a more long-lasting cultural change, when in reality, sometimes they just move the problem, or they call it by a different name, right? The Department of Corrections, if they were on this call, they would say, we don't have solitary. They do. They just call it by different names: administrative segregation, disciplinary segregation. So it is a step forward, but we, and myself as an activist, know that we must continue to fight for the other demands that we have. And behind the Protect Act, I'm not sure if you've read it, it's one of the most revolutionary bills in the nation to end solitary, because we're really advocating for a cultural shift that people, no matter what crimes they've been convicted of or even accused of, are treated humanely. So cultural shift, as I'm sure you're aware, is not something that just happens with shutting down a prison. If the culture isn't changing, if people aren't viewed as humanity, what's probable and almost certain is that the Department of Corrections will just, you know, migrate the policies in Northern to other prisons, which a lot of it is already still happening in other prisons. So
I'm speaking with Raisha Bivens, justice advocate, digital organizer, and board member for Stop Solitary Connecticut. We've been talking about what constitutes solitary confinement. I'm wondering, could you tell me under what circumstances are prison officials allowed to put somebody in solitary? What are the offenses that that would justify in the officials' point of view, putting somebody in solitary confinement?
Yeah, so great question, Tom. And the problem is, even though there's what's called administrative directives that would spell out why someone can be put in solitary confinement, a lot of it is subjective, right? We're in touch with a lot of people that have been formerly incarcerated. We have a lot of those people like that on our coalition, as well as family members. And you know, I know someone whose son was sent to Northern because he was told by the nurse that he couldn't get his heart medication that he was on and that he needed. And he reached to see, you know, the medical record that the nurse was looking at. And he was then accused of attacking the correction officers, which wasn't the case. And he was sent to Northern. I know someone else when the pandemic was at the height in March and April. You know, in New Haven Correctionals, people were complaining, the people incarcerated were complaining because they were getting bologna sandwiches that had mold on them. There was a whole bunch of people, 10 people or more, sent to Northern because they actually were advocating that they have food that was appropriate for them to eat. So although we know that in some circumstances, maybe there are instances of violence where people are actually put in solitary confinement, even with violence, there are ways to separate people from other members that are incarcerated without actually isolating them in these torturous conditions. So our stance is, regardless of what happens, there's a way to safely separate people rather than using solitary confinement.
That's a question I was about to ask you. What's the alternative to solitary confinement, especially in situations where perhaps extreme violence is involved?
Yeah. So someone can be separated from the general population. So for example, if someone had a cellmate and they had an incident with their cellmate, they would be removed. They would be placed on a separate unit where they would be in a cell by themselves. They might still get some time, you know, out of their cell to be with correctional officers, not to be with other people incarcerated. And many prisons in Connecticut actually also have hospitals to where if someone is having an issue, a lot of times it is related to their mental health and they actually need treatment versus just being put in solitary confinement. So when I speak of separation, it is a philosophy amongst the activist community that has worked in other states, you know, states like Colorado that have drastically reduced their use of solitary and have saw violence go down. They're also doing things like really training staff to de-escalate situations and approach people more humanely. And all of those things actually lead to not even having to be reliant on solitary confinement, which has been proven actually to be ineffective in reducing violence. Statistics actually show that it actually increases violence to have people be in solitary confinement. Because in many cases, some people are released straight from those conditions of solitary confinement to the community. And that doesn't serve anybody when the majority of people in prison are actually going to be released to the community at some point. So, New York, who has what's called HALT legislation that they're advocating for, they would call what I'm referring to as separation. They have what they call rehabilitative units. And those are where, you know, if someone, there's a concern about safety, if there's been a violent act, people can be placed on those units temporarily, but they would not remain in their cell all day. They would have contact with correction officers and they would get treatment. And that's the unfortunate thing that doesn't work about solitary is that a lot of times people that are placed in solitary, have an underlying mental health issue and they're not getting treatment for it. Instead, they're being shackled, tortured, and punished when they really need their medications to be looked at and they need better treatment.
There are some calls for the money that the state, that Connecticut, will save by shutting down Northern to be redirected to social services dealing with perhaps some of the problems that, that you've talked about, helping organizations deal with the mental health issues that that some of these folks are dealing with, helping people reenter society, reenter communities more smoothly. Yeah. Will this help with criminal justice reform, generally speaking?
Absolutely. Yeah, if that money saved in Northern, in closing Northern, is reinvested in people who are currently incarcerated and people being released to the community, it will absolutely help them because people will be getting the support and the services that they need to actually be rehabilitated. Most times when people are incarcerated, I believe and we believe as an organization that it's not because people are just inherently predisposed to crime and violence. Usually, you know, as a social worker, I can say usually there's some trauma that people experience. And if they get the right programming that allows them to transform, they will go out into the community and be more productive citizens. In addition, I think to care for someone in the community that has mental illness is around, I believe it's 13,000 or something like that per person. To have someone incarcerated, an average conservatively could be around $54,000. So I say all that to say it costs so much more to treat and care for someone that has a mental illness in prison than in the community. So if these services are also invested in the community, into communities and people that have been formerly incarcerated, we might actually even be able to prevent, you know, recidivism and reincarceration. So it will absolutely help overall in criminal justice reform and in really reforming, and I like to say transforming the system.
In your work with Stop Solitary Connecticut, have you found that Black and Brown inmates are disproportionately put in solitary?
Absolutely. Connecticut is the highest in the nation for disproportionately putting Black and Brown people in solitary confinement. I believe it's 86% of the people that are in solitary confinement are Black and Latino people. So it's very clear from the numbers that we are doing that here in Connecticut.
And your efforts to the organization's efforts to do away with solitary, can that have an impact on this kind of institutional racism?
Absolutely. Automatically it will, because we're saying that all people in all prisons in Connecticut should be out of their cells minimally 8 hours out the day. We're saying that people need to have mental health treatment no matter what. It'll absolutely address institutional racism, because this is one of the ways that institutional racism continues to be perpetuated amongst the incarcerated population and in our society in general. And one of the other components of our bill that'll really help eliminate that culture of racism is the fact that we are saying we need to have an ombudsman for people incarcerated in Connecticut. It was in place years ago in Connecticut, and it needs to be brought back, because what the ombudsman would do is ongoingly address any complaints, any grievances from incarcerated people, and really ensure that they're resolved in a humane and just way. And also a part of our legislation is that there will be a community board with a certain percentage of formerly incarcerated people on that board who will work hand in hand with the ombudsman to continue to recommend changes that will make a difference in the system ongoingly. So that's a structure that will not just lead to temporary change, because like I said, if you take away a system and you're not training people or really holding them accountable for the cultural shift, what's likely is people will revert back to the past. So that's why these other components of our bill, the ombudsman, the community board, are so important to eliminating a culture that's founded on institutional racism and bias.
Ms. Bivens, thanks so much for your time today and your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Raisha Bivens is a justice advocate, digital organizer, and board member for Stop Solitary Connecticut. Young people in prisons is a condition that some activists say should not exist. They say it's a symptom of a social system that's broken down and has failed to properly care for children and youth. Last week, we spoke with Yusuf Abdul-Qadir. He's the inaugural senior strategist for racial justice at the New York Civil Liberties Union. Abdul-Qadir spoke about why young people are put in prisons and about his work to end solitary confinement of youth at the Onondaga County's Justice Center in New York.
The way that our criminal legal system has set up zero tolerance, both policies in schools and in communities, has manifested in the outcomes that have resulted in the suicide of individuals like Khalif Browder, whose name is a name I have to lift up because he is why I do this work. His suicide is fundamentally why I came to this organization. And when organizers and advocates and faith workers were in the Onondaga County Justice Center, letting folks know that indeed 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds who were charged previous to raise the age as adults were unable to afford to make bail. And because they couldn't afford to make bail, were being held in the Justice Center, which is a jail in Onondaga County. And that they were isolated and placed in solitary confinement for a number of reasons, largely illegitimate reasons. That's how we find young people in the criminal legal system. You know, it could be that a student was experiencing the manifestation of their disability, as we have seen, and a police officer be called and that child is then arrested, right? It could be that an individual was stopped and frisked and accused of a crime and couldn't afford bail and therefore languished in the jail until someone, either their public defender was able to get them out or a relative was able to bail them out. This is the way that the carceral state, the prison industrial complex that we have in New York State, really devastates the opportunities for young people to thrive. And we spend more money on keeping people in jails and in prisons than we do educating and housing them. And it's deeply concerning that as a state that considers itself to be a progressive state, a state that is the empire state, a state that's supposed to be the beacon of democracy, that we still in 2021 are conducting ourselves with these types of policies and approaches. And so it is because of how we have viewed especially young Black people as inherently ripe for danger, inherently violent, inherently warranting our concern and fear, and therefore necessitating us locking them up as far away as possible without providing any sort of assistance by way of mentorship, by way of crisis intervention, by way of mental health therapy, et cetera, that we find ourselves to where we are today.
What replaced solitary at Onondaga County's Justice Center as a result of the work that New York Civil Liberties Union did there?
Yeah, and so the significant limitations, both of the ordinance that was passed and through our litigation, really precluded individuals from being, with some exception, and kind of indefinitely locked up. There were limitations on the number of hours that any individual could be placed in isolation. And eventually, young people were through Raise the Age, having to be able to be provided different types of experiences outside of being in the jail. Now, it still happens where there are young people who are jailed, and it requires continuous monitoring to make sure that they're not going back to their old behavior. But effectively, it wasn't just about them being placed in solitary. It was also about the denial of their education opportunities, right? So they were required by New York State Constitution to be provided a sound, basic education. And the Syracuse City School District was not doing that. They were not providing children who were in the Justice Center with access to education. They weren't providing students who had IEPs, typically students with disabilities, and an IEP is an individualized education plan. They weren't providing them with the requirements to fulfill their IEP. And so many students and many young people were being denied what New York State Constitution requires as an inherent fundamental constitutional right. And so these are the kinds of realities that young people found themselves in the Justice Center. And I think it's easy for people to think that, you know, if you get arrested and you go to the jail, that it's because you've done something, right? I think we have a real law and order, you know, SVU approach to our understanding of the criminal legal system. It's kind of Hollywoodized. It's done in a way that makes us think that this is how the system operates. But quite frankly, what happened in Onondaga County is that 67% of the people there were legally innocent, because in the United States, you're innocent until you are proven guilty. The adverse was the case for many people who couldn't afford it. They were guilty until they can prove their innocence. And once you are in there, you will do everything and anything almost to be able to get free. You will cop to a plea deal. You will, you will not necessarily be able to fight for your defense, and push forward your ability to fight for your freedom. And it's really against the fundamental values that we have as a country. And so, you know, there's more to see and there's more work to be done as it relates to Onondaga County Justice Center. And, you know, I think it's certainly a better station than it was then, but I don't want to give the impression that it's all roses and everything is going great. I think there are still significant challenges that we have to overcome. And I think our fundamental understanding of how we approach quote unquote law and order really is what is at the core of why we have these issues today.
And is that the crux of the matter, getting people to understand that in order to move in the direction of criminal justice reform, of prison reform?
Yeah, I mean, and again, I want to be clear, because we don't use the word criminal justice because it doesn't feel that there's much justice in the system. Mm-hmm. And so it's a legal system that's structured around criminality. And so we refer to it as a criminal legal system. But I think we should be cautious by giving the impression that there's a lot of justice in the system. There's nothing just about putting 15 and 16 and 17-year-olds in jails. There's nothing just about that. There's nothing just about suspending students in such disproportionate rates, particularly Black and brown and poor students. There's nothing just about that. And so I think we should be cautious in the types of words we use. And it's part of why we do this education, this public education, to get people to understand that honestly, the way the system is functioning is not haphazard. It's not accidental. It's designed. I think we talk about the war on drugs as, for instance, being failed. You know, we talk about the failed policies of mass incarceration. They didn't fail. They did precisely what they were designed to do, to lock lots of people up, especially Black and brown, and to throw away the key without any opportunity for redemption, without any opportunity of being, you know, restored back to society, without any opportunity for there to be kind of a meaningful reintegration into society. And prison is not a place where people are going to, you know, prevent their likelihood of engaging in criminal conduct. We are finding that prison is a place and jails are places where deplorable human conditions continue to exist that are quite frankly probably close to, if not at, violations of basic ideals of human rights.
Could you talk a little bit about how climate and environmental justice fit into racial and criminal justice?
Yeah, I mean, if you notice the distinction between me talking about environmental justice and climate justice versus environmental law and climate change, it's important because the imperative is justice. The communities that are most disproportionately impacted by environmental racism and climate injustice are Black and brown communities. They're the communities that are exposed to the greatest numbers of pollutants, environmental pollutants, whether they're toxic waste sites or approximation to major thoroughfares and roadways or schools and homes that have lead-based paint or lead pipes, asbestos and other sorts of indoor air quality concerns. And as climate change continues to implicate communities and further degrade the environment, as sea levels rise, those communities who have been geographically isolated due to redlining and previous policies of racial injustice are going to be the communities that are also further exposed. You know, we, you know, think about the ways that, you know, mass incarceration has criminalized generations of Black and Brown boys and girls and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters. And we've seen the infusion of them into a criminal legal system where we talk about the prison industrial complex as a place that takes, in the context of New York State, downstate New York City residents and funnels them upstate in rural towns and villages and communities to be the sole employer, where they not only manufacture, and get this, right, in Attica prison in New York, there are prisoners who are manufacturing furniture that are called the Attica Collection. And New York State is profiting off of that. And the people who are working as the janitors, who are working as the, you know, the cooks and the folks maintaining the prison are the prisoners. And as it relates to COVID, in both of these contexts, what we saw is people who are living in communities that have high exposures to environmental pollutants are communities largely Black and Brown that, because of those in access to food, right? They live in food deserts. You don't have the gut biology that will give you the vitamin D nutritional capacity to be more able to withstand fighting COVID-19 should you contract it. You're more likely to be a person who is a first responder. You may be a person who has diabetes and high blood pressure or respiratory illnesses because of the lack of access to healthy, nutritious food, or because of your approximation to environmental pollutants and horrible air quality in your neighborhoods. And those things kind of merge with COVID, especially when it comes to prisons. You know, the irony is that in a moment where supply chains presented complications and being able to manufacture hand sanitizer, prisoners in New York State were manufacturing hand sanitizer, but they weren't able to use that hand sanitizer. And that's just a question of the morality of the state with which we live in. Should we have a state that says that there are two tiers of human beings in our society? Should we have a state that says that no one is redeemable, that it, irrespective to what you may have committed or a crime that you may have engaged in at some period of your life, that you are not worthy to be provided access to basic capacity to live as a human being? And COVID has presented all of these things to us in a very clear, unambiguous way, where we've seen whether, as I spoke to you, you're in a community and you're an essential worker, largely Black or Brown, or you're a person who's incarcerated, who's manufacturing goods and services, but are not able to benefit from the goods and services so that your health and well-being is also protected. Irrespective to all that, COVID has shown the vast hypocrisy between the kind of country we project to be and the kind of country and the state that we're finding ourselves actually being.
Mr. Abdul-Qadir, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yusuf Abdul-Qadir is the Senior Racial Justice Strategist at the New York Civil Liberties Union. Prison is no place for kids or young adults. That's the finding of a recent report by the Office of the Child Advocate in Connecticut. The report examined how young people are treated in the Manson Youth and York Correctional Institutions. It found the deeper young people sink into the justice system in Connecticut, the less likely they are to get the services they need to improve their condition and safely return to their communities. To further understand the report and how to transform the conditions for incarcerated youth, we turn to Christina Quaranta. She's the executive director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance, and she joins us via Skype. Ms. Quaranta, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. First of all, could you tell us a bit about the Alliance? What is its goal and what constitutes it?
The Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance is a youth adult partnership. We are a public policy and advocacy organization, and our mission is to end the criminalization of youth in Connecticut. And in normal times here, we're located right in Bridgeport, but we do statewide work.
And then the next thing I think we should define is youth. When we talk about youth, what age group are we talking about?
So for the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance, prior to the year 2021, we advocated for and worked with youth up until the age of 18. And now we are moving towards working with young people, or what some folks call the emerging adult population, which is through the age of 24.
How does a young person end up in the juvenile justice system in Connecticut to begin with? How do they essentially become criminalized, I guess is the word?
I think there are a lot of different factors that bring a young person into the juvenile or the criminal justice system here in Connecticut. If you look at what services are available for young people and how education has been going, especially during the pandemic, we've really seen it highlighted that young people who are not able to engage in the regular, whether it's mental health services, after school, sports, whatever pro-social activities or sort of therapeutic mental health, et cetera, that they were able to prior to the pandemic, those folks are really struggling and looking for support that they haven't been able to get in a meaningful way. I think if we talk about, since the time, these are the times that we're in now, 2021, a young person really gets involved in either system when they are forced to make a choice or make a bad decision, right? And they are arrested by the police and brought before a judge. Maybe they're detained in detention for some period of time. And then there are different locked facilities here in Connecticut that a young person could end up in. And there are a couple other different routes too that we look at in Connecticut in terms of when someone is arrested, are they diverted from the system? You know, do they go through a juvenile review board, or do they get to sort of take a lesser path, right? Less consequences, sort of more of a rehabilitative approach for young people that we know works better, because we know that incarcerating a young person, detaining them, is not good for their health, and it doesn't actually improve public safety.
And when we talk about Manson Youth and your correctional institutions, those are really, to some extent, prisons for young people.
Yes. So I know you mentioned at the beginning of the story the report that the Office of the Child Advocate just released, mm-hmm. which is an update to a 2019 report. They just released that this past November. And that centers around Manson Youth Institution and York Correctional. So Manson Youth is an adult prison run by the Department of Corrections that young men are sent to when they are charged as an adult from the age of 15 to 18, and then adults under the Connecticut state law 18 to 21. They are all incarcerated inside of Manson Youth Institution. And then York Correctional is where young women go, charged as adults 15 to 18. They are incarcerated there. I think it's something that's important to highlight that folks should be aware of in terms of Manson Youth Institution is that it's currently under federal investigation for civil rights violations of the young people that are incarcerated there or have been.
And the report that that you brought up again, the report by the Child Advocates Office in Connecticut, it described a number of, rather disturbing conditions that young people endure in these facilities. Use of pepper spray, being shackled in their cells, confined up to, I think, 23 hours. Are these situations the rule or the exception? And are these tactics approved for use on young people?
The situations that are highlighted in the Office of the Child Advocate report that you mentioned about use of chemical agent on young people, mm-hmm. for behavior deterrence, for behavior control, are used by the Department of Corrections and are legal under state law inside of those facilities. However, in other spaces in Connecticut where you will find young people, chemical agent use is banned. And if you look at the national research, look at national experts in other states, they do not use chemical agents on young people as a means of control or as a means of behavior management or anything like that. And it's really something that we have been speaking with the folks at the Department of Corrections about, that they need to stop. We need to all work together to find alternatives for use of chemical restraints and need to look towards a different path, because chemical agents are not the answer.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. And you also mentioned solitary confinement, and that is a big underlined, bold problem that occurs inside the Department of Corrections, especially inside of Manson youth and your correctional. So if we talk about your correctional first, because we don't want to put the girls on the back burner, but since there's such a low number of young women in Connecticut charged as an adult, oftentimes in those spaces and cells inside of York, there's only 1 to 2 young women. So they are really subject to isolation just by a matter of how many of them are incarcerated inside. And if we look at the rates of solitary confinement, you can call it confinement to quarters. The Department of Corrections has a lot of terms for the same thing, and that's holding someone in their cell for periods of time for punishment or just for the sake of movement, right? So the way that the Department of Corrections works is they have to be mindful of what's happening in the rest of the prison and who's moving around. And sometimes because of staffing or different reasons, someone is left inside a cell for long, unacceptable periods of time. And it's also used a lot as form of punishment, right? And we know that that is really detrimental to young people's mental health.
Are many of the young people in the system, even those not subjected to solitary confinement, are many of them dealing with mental health situations, mental health problems?
Yes, many of them are dealing with mental health situations, whether or not they have been subjected to solitary confinement or not. There are some numbers located in that Office of Child Advocate report that talks about the percentage of young people that are in the Department of Corrections custody that do have mental health issues, right? And what needs to be highlighted there is that the level of mental health care that is needed, that these young people need, is not being given by the Department of Corrections. And the Office of the Child Advocate does a really good job of highlighting that and giving an outline of what they get and how it lacks. And I think one more point on the mental health piece is it's really important to understand that during the pandemic, which started almost a year ago now, young people inside of the Department of Corrections have really been suffering in terms of mental health care because of social distancing, and not being able to have their usual groups, lack of staff, whatever that looks like. That's been a real issue. And there have been identified some instances of young people that are at some of the highest level of need. It's rated on a scale of 1 to 4 that just get what we call a drive-by of their cell, a 15-minute conversation, and that's it for the day, which is unacceptable in any period of time.
I'm talking with Christina Quaranta, the executive director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. The investigation that we've been talking about, the report from the Child Advocates Office, also focused on the experiences of Black young people because they're disproportionately represented in this system. Why are so many young Black people in the system?
That's a good question, Tom, about why are so many young Black people, young Black children and people of color incarcerated inside of both the Department of Corrections and also in the facilities where we house and younger folks, right, where you're charged as a juvenile. So if we look at it, over half of the youth under 18 that were admitted to Manson and York are 17, and just over 80% of those folks were youth of color, right? And as we saw the amounts of the percentage go up for folks who were incarcerated that were Black or people of color, we also saw that they also had increasing behavioral health and alcohol or drug needs, right, that just aren't getting addressed. And it's a huge, huge percentage. I'm looking at numbers here for fiscal year 2018. 51% of the folks inside of Manson or York identified as Black, whereas only 18% identified as white. It's a huge issue, and it's something we talk a lot about at the Alliance and with different stakeholders around the state of Connecticut, really trying to address what are the drivers to incarceration. And we know that it has a lot to do with, and specifically highlighted by the pandemic, but was also going on before, because these are not new numbers, economic insecurity, lack of access to education, lack of access to mentors and credible messengers for folks. It's really a systemic failure at all points as to why Black and youth of color are ending up disproportionately inside of the Department of Corrections.
You mentioned when we started talking that the goal of the alliance. A goal is to keep young people from having to enter this criminal justice system to begin with, giving them an alternative path to rehabilitation. What is the path forward? What does the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance want from, for instance, the Lamont administration? To what can be done at the state level?
The Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance would really like to see the Lamont administration step up and have a voice in how young people and folks in general who are incarcerated in Connecticut are being treated, especially during the pandemic. We would really like to see more folks released with resources where appropriate to alleviate some of the COVID-19 concerns. Connecticut really needs to put inside of its budget line items, and we all just saw Governor Lamont's budget that came out. They really need to invest in youth, family, and communities and make sure that both the judicial branch and the Department of Corrections have the funding that's appropriate to make sure that youth have wraparound, intensive, community-based care, and that the only options are not just diversion or ending up somewhere on the deep end in an adult prison, right? We need something in the in-between. We need a 24/7 wraparound model, and those do exist nationally. So we need to look into that, see how much that's going to cost us, and plan for that, because youth and families here need that, and we owe that to them.
From a purely fiscal perspective, is there a cost savings by keeping young people from entering Manson or York or the criminal justice system to begin with?
There absolutely, from a financial perspective, is a cost savings piece there. If you're not incarcerating young people or even putting them in detention for a period of time, the cost savings, I know we have outlined on our website, just referring to how much, for instance, it costs to hold a child in detention, which is within the judicial branch, how much that costs a day and what we could be doing with that money instead, right? The same with the Department of Corrections. There's a savings in closing prisons and really, truly reinvesting those funds right back into the community where the people that are being incarcerated come from and investing in services. There's absolutely savings. And there's another organization that folks might be interested in looking into. It's Connecticut Voices for Children. And they do a bunch of research on juvenile and criminal justice in terms of what cost savings look like for not sending a young person to detention or not incarcerating them either in youth or adult prison here in Connecticut.
Ms. Quaranta, thanks so much for your time today and your insights. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much for having me.
Christina Quaranta is the executive director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. What's your opinion about this? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our show today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.